But you just give me raw figures without any narrative, any context. I can't respond.
But did you take the time to read or to see or to put it into your own context? So instead of
I would not have access to persons that you would have. But I'm saying that the program as it is is based on what was pledged to the IMF that will be done to get what they got.
All right, fair enough. Peter, you wanted to make a point as well.
It's a homegrown effort. Mm-hmm.
No, I feel it important to say that this is a conversation that we are having. A lot of people are seeing me coming across as being unsympathetic to a person because I'm speaking to a post and the irrelevance of a post or irrelevance of a function. I have a challenge with some of the functions of the public service, but I appreciate that we're dealing with real human beings. And I've said it on this program before. I know what it is like to lose a job. I know what it is like to lose a job the same month that I sign a mortgage. So I know that it is a process that is not easy. It's difficult. Emotionally, it is taxing. And I do feel that a lot of those people who are in those situations, no one needs support. But, you know, there's a comparative base that we have to be able to say, well, look, we understand the challenges that people will face, and let's try to ameliorate them. And that's the reason why certain initiatives are being taken now to help people in that regard. But we also understand that we have to fix the public service. And I want to tell you about two situations. One of them is in relation to my teaching at the University of the West Indies. And we had a part-time program where you had to be full-time for 2 years. And we had a large number of people who did the whole 4 years part-time. And 99.9% of them were public servants. Now, I don't have a difficulty with someone improving themselves. Let me make that clear. But I always found it fascinating that we never found people from the private sector who would get a day off or get several hours off during the day to come up and work, to come up to university and study. But we had so many people who were working at the university, who were working at the community college, who were working in the public sector, that were able to come and complete degrees part-time, even though the university requirement was that you should do the last 2 years full-time. And that's interesting, because the public service is a place where you can go to your head of department and say, look, you know, boss, I need to finish my education. He will say he understands that and whatnot. But in the final analysis, Sanka, somebody still has to pay for it. And as people who are on the receiving end of the service, we also appreciate that that is a tax on government. And the question is, can we continue to afford that? The other point I wanted to make was with regard to the thing. I had to apply for a birth certificate for someone who was born in some village in the United Kingdom many years ago. And I went online. I found the person's date of birth and whatnot, and I sent in an application. I paid, I think it's £10 using my credit card, and the birth certificate came to me in the mail probably in a 2 or 3 week period, right? Very simple process. I had to interact with nobody, ask nobody anything. You try to do that in Barbados. And to start with, to tell you that unless you are a relative of the person is your child or your mother or something like that, you have to get a letter from somebody explaining the reasons why you need to have it. You go into the office, you stand in line. You approach a clerk, the clerk completes documentation, then you take it to another person who takes money from you, and then you go back to the clerk. And then you wait a period of time, and then you get back a document from someone else. Now, nobody can explain to me why that process has to be the way it is. It is an unnecessary use of the human resources. And people will say, oh, well, you know, it is important that you have these checks and balances. But the reality of the situation is that if a country like the United Kingdom can do it differently, why can't we? Now, I appreciate that all of these people are pleasant. The ones that work in the registry are very lovely people, and they deserve to be employed. So it is not about them. It is about a process which is obsolete and which is strangling Barbados. You are forcing people like myself who work for myself, right, to take an hour or two of my day to complete business when I could be earning money. But you force me into a process where I have to be engaging with the public sector on an ongoing basis in a way that it is not necessary. And I think it is part of our productivity challenge that we have to deal with all of these things. But I accept fully it has to have a human face because you're dealing with people. You're not dealing with numbers on posts. You're dealing with people.
No, nobody can forward with that.
I thought Sanka was supposed to be making a point.
Yeah, who's
the moderator? You or Corinne?
I wanted to come in here to deal with the whole thing about...
All right, gentlemen. Maturity is the name of the game. Let's go. Sanka Price.
I wanted to come in here to talk about the perception that the moderators are in favor of whatever the government is doing and they're easy on the government and whatnot. And... you know, politics is about emotion. Facts don't really matter. unless you can manipulate those facts to suit yourself. And the perceptions are all that counts. But you know, the thing about it is, I am more interested in the facts of most things. And I cannot sit in a moderator's chair and I hear somebody give me a general, something saying something in general or something that is wrong. And I have, and I know the facts of it, and I do not correct that individual. When you correct people and you point out to them that they are wrong, in other words, they're lying, then you hear that you are against the party, because the first thing they say, they take that political line rather than understanding that, hey, you can come with a line of argument on anything, but if there is evidence to show that what you're saying is totally incorrect or you're being economical with the truth, then it has to be pointed out to you. It has to be so that you do not have the wrong narrative out there. And that is what we like to do. We like to come to a program. People like to come to a program, say whatever they want to say. Not with me in the chair. It ain't gonna happen. As long as I know that there is evidence, as long as I am aware of the evidence there to show differently, I am gonna say that to you. You don't have to believe it. You don't even have to take it. But I'm gonna point out to you where it was said, when it was said, and who said it. And speaking on that last point, I'll let Glenn get back in here now, but Glenn, I want to remind you that 3 weeks ago at St. Christopher Primary School, the Prime Minister said that she was advised by her lawyers, by the lawyers, that they would have to wait until the whole debt restructuring exercise was done with the T-bills and whatnot before she can speak towards the pensioners in particular. She made that point. So I'm just putting that in. Glenn, hold on. Hold on. She made that point strictly to show that she was interested in the pensioners. So all I'm saying, as I try to do with callers, is that if I am aware of facts that were put there, that you should point them out. You can have your opinion on it. I'm not disagreeing with you. Nothing, but I'm saying that at least the Prime Minister said that in this particular case, so I'm making you aware if you weren't aware.
But Sanka, I did not accuse of the Prime Minister of not caring. She said that it would be correction. She said yesterday by the 8th of November. I heard her in her address three Sundays ago, so say that she was unhappy and something would be done. So I tell you that I was not criticizing her for this.
I didn't take you as criticizing her. I was just... You gave no indication, Glenn, that you heard her say that. The way I understood it from what you said was a simple case of that... You're now coming now to deal with the pensioners.
So all I'm saying is I am just bringing
to your attention that that was said. If you heard it, fine, no problem. Let's move on.
I'm not responsible for how you hear or understand something. I know what I said. And I can't respond for that. But the point is, I said I'm surprised that all the economists and whatnot, they're the ones who advise, they're the ones who do the permutations.
Massive cabinet.
And I'm saying I'm surprised that nobody seems to have
nobody pick it up.
Of behavioral economics.
You pick it up.
Let me just ask Glenn. Glenn, have you seen the breakdown of who owes what in treasury bills and debentures and various government paper?
Not in detail.
Okay, good. And this was okay. When I went to the launch, that was what I asked for. That was the question, the only question, well, two questions I asked. The first question I asked was the 75%, whether it was 75% of the holders or 75% of the amount. And it was clarified it was 75% of the amount. The second thing I asked was a breakdown of who owed what. And the governor said to me that he didn't have it at the time. And I asked if it could be sent to me. And before I left, it was. I shared it with members of the media. The reason why I asked for that was this. Because I knew when I sat in the chair, whenever I had the opportunity, people were going to talk about all the poor people, how many people were affected without knowing the numbers. And I wanted to know the numbers. I also wanted to know the breakout in amounts. so that if you said somebody called and said, I used to get, as you used the quote, $5,000 and I now get $300, what's the level of investment that would have received $5,000 and why was it cut to $300? So that's why I asked for a breakout of the who owes what and in what categories. And the governor and the central bank graciously gave it to me. And it was shared with the media. It's unfortunate that you didn't get a copy because you'll be able to see the numbers of those affected and why it was necessary to see the overall picture before zeroing in on the numbers themselves. Sanka has a copy with
him. But Dennis, let me just hop in here. Glenn, in terms of pensioners, we're talking 1,725 pensioners. Of that 1,725 pensioners, 1,120 have invested up to $100,000. Okay? But collectively, those 1,120 pensioners, they have $43,278,000 in the treasury notes and debentures and whatnot. In fact, in all, of those 1,725, they have $483 million invested.
And therefore?
I'm just giving you the raw stats. I'm giving you the raw stats, Glenn. I am not coming to any opinion.
I saw some of that.
Yes, because I made sure that it got into the papers. But the whole point I am making to you is that this is the sort of thing that, and you know me well enough, you know that I like to put these figures and everything out there, okay? So that when we're discussing issues, that people at least have the facts. Whether they want to ignore the facts or not is up to them.
Fair enough.
All right, I want to put this one in here for clarity, and then we'll take a call. This one is from Shane Lowe, the president of the Barbados Economic Society. He says, hey, Corey, I'm rushing in to an appointment now, but I think something that should be highlighted is that our targets as a country, as agreed with the IMF, help to dictate our options. We have agreed to reduce the debt to GDP by 60% by 2033. That in itself dictates a certain path for the fiscal balance, which dictates a certain magnitude of expenditure cuts and tax increases through combination of taxes, debt restructuring, and other spending cuts. If we want to have a smaller adjustment, then we would have to question whether we can relax the constraint of reaching the debt target over that period. If we can, then fine. If we can't, then the options must be viewed in that context and become limited. Brad Stat Sunday, good morning. Let's take a call at this time. You're on the air.
Hello, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Yeah, well, good afternoon to the panel. I'm sorry the lady is not here with you today. And I was hoping that it was heard more from the public, which is bearing the brunt of this austerity program. I'm really trying to come to grips with how we are engaging in today's discussion, a discussion about the austerity program, without examining how we got here. Here to this stage where the working poor are being required to finance previous extravagance and even 40% of the otherwise normal costs as offered by other bidders. And I make particular reference to the front page of yesterday's Saturday Sun and also today's Sunday Sun. And I am just wondering if this continued exploitation of the public purse is going to be allowed to continue when we get into these public-private sector agreements without the public being, when I say the public, the man in the street, being offered an opportunity to take part. Are we going to have the same people, the same names, going to get all these agreements to take over our assets? That is the question I would like to ask, and would like to see how it's going to work out. And we also had sometime in the press again, and thank God for the press we have here, and when I say the press, the media we have in Barbados. We also have this system which allows some legal person to extract high fees.
There's something happening in your background that's very distracting.
Oh, let me see. I don't know.
Sound like geese or something. I'm not so sure.
No, it sounds more like remote control cars.
This room is perfectly quiet.
Okay.
Can you still hear?
No, unless it's glowing. Anyhow, it's really distracting.
It's
better now. Yeah, it was another.
Agreements for legal services, and this is without any conscience. I know of one very high-profile lawyer who worked for many years in this country, and he has assured me he has never, in all his working years with big contracts, ever got $1 million for his fees. And this seemed to have been rampant. Now, is it fair to the taxpayers for this type of thing to continue? Is it fair that we're going to have these things reported in the press, and then we're hearing there's investigation going on, and then we don't hear anything about the reports of those investigations? And then, because all of these millions or maybe hundreds of millions of dollars being extracted, are we, the public, going to be asked to pay additional taxes? I think that is something that really and seriously wants looking at. And it's probably something that your panelists might want to form a little discussion for the next few minutes.
Okay, we will take that definitely under consideration. And we thank you for putting that on the table, along with the many other WhatsAppers who have been saying the same thing. Well, it's time for the latest.
I know we have to go to the latest. Mm-hmm. But, Corey, the fact about it is that if we started out asking, how did we get here? Then the same criticism that all we're trying to do is to pull down the last regime would come about. So you can't win.
Well, we're going to touch on that and many other things as it relates to the austerity and the future here on the Round Table, the Moderator's Round Table on Brass Tacks. We're back on Brass Tacks Sunday, brought to you with the kind compliments of Williams Industries Incorporated. It's the Moderator's panel looking at austerity and the future. We've discussed the whole idea of austerity itself, some of the measures implemented by the Mia Motley-led administration and its implementation. One of the things and we were talking about as we went over to the latest is this whole idea of how did we get here, and the fact that that's where this discussion should have started. I disagree slightly, and that is because I think we need to get on with the business. I think we were doing more monitoring of that than we need an evaluation now. We were talking about that over the last 8 years. I think one of the things we need to extract from that, though, the things we need to avoid repeating. Off air, we were talking to Sanka, and he made a good point, which is, if we concentrate too much on how we got here, we could even be further wrongfully accused of just hitting at the last administration. So that can turn out to be a whole waste of time exercise. But I do agree that we need to concentrate on how to avoid this going forward. I had a WhatsApp here that says, you know what, as they examine what we're going through, that we will be back here 12 to 15 years from now. So one of the things I think that we need to also look at in greater depth was this whole idea of the alternative. I was a little disappointed that people jumped on one example I gave, which was the 3 to 4 day, but that is not the beginning and the end of what alternatives mean. Of course, there's the stimulus, there's the do nothing and send home 10,000 people at the value of the dollar. There's the go after the big business for the millions owed. There's so many other programs. There's the Solution Barbados non-austerity alternative program. And there are so many other things. As I did research for this program, where very few countries have actually done non-austerity successful programs. Many other countries tried it and found themselves in greater debt because it's really a gamble, some of the programs. There's also the citizen by invitation using high net worth and your diasporas. We've seen that successful in, I think it's in Kitts, and there's another country that tried it. And there's the whole flip side of that in terms of you're inviting terrorists and money launderers and so on. To me, there have not been enough discussion on the alternatives, although I think the boat has sailed because we've already signed on the dotted line. We have our targets from the IMF, and we could probably use the rest of this program once the moderators agree to look at what the future looks like. I think we have an opportunity and a responsibility to prepare the public. I heard it said in this very chair by my fellow moderators that this is just the beginning. It's going to get harder. And if we do not prepare the public, Dennis made the point, we have two generations of Barbadians that don't know what tightening the belt means. We have people who've been living fairly good, you know, whether it be on credit cards or not. They do not understand what is coming. Gentlemen, ladies even on the line, please, can we have a discussion on what the future of this austerity program means for our Barbadian people? Dennis Johnson.
I'm glad you touched on the credit card, because that's one of the things I noticed. The millions used on credit card debt in Barbados. We talk a lot about the public sector debt. Private sector entities, private individuals, their debt has to be a factor in this. There's another part of our economy that we pay scant attention to that is going to come into sharp focus in an austerity program. The underground economy, the drug money that supports a lot of people who otherwise would be involved in begging government for a handout. If that drops out as well, the question is, what do we do to earn? We go back to that again. For far too long, we have lived, as I said, on loans and luck. We have a serious problem to deal with in private financing, credit card debt, bank charges. The last time I was on the program, I talked about the Joint Select Committee of Parliament in Trinidad calling in the bankers to ask them about charges. If the banks start complaining about the hit they're going to take on the treasury notes and debentures, charges will go up. So when you talk about preparing people for what comes next, I think when people send WhatsApp messages saying, oh, you're sitting up there pretty because, you know, you fired the moderators. 2010, I got that. Okay? Because we had two program directors and they say, you gotta go. We want the other one. So it is not a question of taking things in isolation and saying, oh, it's 1,500 people there, or it's 100 people there, or it's 69 people there, or you're looking at numbers. When you have people who are in the workforce earning a living, but the credit card debt is what, 900 million? That was the figure?
No, I think it's
347 million.
Actually.
Thank you very much. It was the interest payment I was looking at, which was 9 million?
Yeah.
There was a 9 million figure in there somewhere that stuck in my brain. It may have been interest charges, but.
Yeah.
Right. So we have $345 million from people who are working, gainful employment.
If I may, Dennis, just come in here, just read it. About 93% of the, what we're talking about here is that the credit card, Barbados have racked up $347 million in credit card debt by the end of last year.
Right.
And there were 91,000 credit cards in 2015.
That's what it was. That's the figure, right?
And now there are 129,000 2 years later, mm-hmm. which is in end of 2017.
And they were paying on average 13% interest.
Yes. Something like that.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Good. Just wanted to put that on the table.
And the next point, of that $347 million that is owed, 93%, which is the crux of your point, 93% of that sum is owned by individuals and households. So that's the average person as against an institution or any company or anything like that. 93%.
So there you go. Peter, I want to ask you a question. As someone who traveled through the Caribbean and you see various economies and how they work, their ups, their downs, and so on. In terms of preparing Barbadian for what austerity can look like, where do you see Barbados going over the next 18 months to 5 years, 4 years or so?
Yeah, I mean, I was actually making some notes, and one of the points I wanted to make mention of is the Grenada model, because in many ways our structural adjustment is patterned after the Grenada model. Grenada was when they went into their program in 2013, they were indebted almost to the levels that we were, and in a space of 4 years, they've been able to turn the situation around as a result of negotiating haircuts and so on to bring their debt now to within a reasonable domain. It's been rough. I mean, the difference with Grenada and Barbados is that Grenada salaries are low, considerably lower than they are here. Government doesn't offer the kind of services that the government of Barbados offers, so there wasn't a lot of fallout there. And there are less public servants in Grenada, comparatively speaking, than in Barbados. So the size of the public service, the fact that they're not paid that well, and for many other reasons, the blunt of the austerity was less intense than it will be in Barbados because of the number of people that we employ and the tremendous number of services that government has been able to execute. But I do feel that there's considerable good that can come out of it. I'm hoping that one of the things that starts is that we start to eat better and that we reduce our dependence on a lot of slightly more expensive processed food and so on. I think that is an important change that can be made. I also remember when Jamaica went through their issues, you know, one of the things that started was a whole lot of people started businesses at home. And that's another thing I think can happen. So instead of relying on a supermarket to supply goods, in many instances, people will shift their dependence to family and friends that are growing vegetables, that are doing little household businesses. And I mean, already it happens a lot where so many people do put themselves on a weekend and so, and make good money doing it. And I think that the informal sector will grow. We have to be prepared for that. I think we have to have special national insurance initiatives to capture some of these people and to manage them. And then my big thing is migration in the future. And this is the part of the program that we haven't heard about. And I hope that as the program grows, we look at migration or immigration more seriously. And we provide realistic facilities for us to grow this economy and grow the number of people that live in here. I think the 15,000 Guyanese that we chased away in 2008, we need to invite back. It's a major blow to our economy. And one of the best ways to grow your GDP is to grow the number of people living here. And I think we need to make Barbados an attractive place for people who want to migrate, who want to come and work. And instead of having somebody come in and working for 6 months, going and coming back and doing it illegally, we need to say to them, look, come and let's do it legally. You come in, we give you a work permit at a reasonable price. We give you a facility to come and set up and work. And the thing is that you pay national insurance and you make your contribution in a legitimate way. Instead of creating hurdles to get people chased away from Barbados as illegal immigrants or working illegally, we have to create facilities to have more people come in to live and work here. Because we cannot do it by getting people to have more babies, which was the position that the previous government seemed to have taken. That's foolishness. We have to do it the way that Canada is doing it. We have to do it the way the United States does it, by encouraging immigration. Mm-hmm. And that's some of the ideas that I think should be part of the phase 3 and 4. And I'm hopeful that we will hear something about it. But the USA still does it. Mm-hmm. I mean, they got how many people in this train are walking towards the border? I guarantee you half of them can get in.
Yeah.